Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Rich Herring's Less Worth It podcast. With me, Rich Herring, and my guest, Arthur Smith. You probably know you can buy the Emergency Questions book at www.gofasterstripe.com. You can get a signed copy of that there. You can get a copy with a Shrek in it. And you can get a personalised copy with whatever you want written in it by me or an extra emergency question that would just be for you. But now, if you're fed up of carrying a book around and you own an Apple product like an iPad or an iPhone, you can get Emergency Questions on your device. It's at the App Store. It's called Emergency Questions. Put Rahel Astapa in there as well, and you'll definitely get it. It's got some free questions, and then you can pay for extra packs, which include the whole book. There's another one which is for dating, 100 questions for dating. And there's 100 questions for kids, which are kid-friendly, as long as you don't mind me talking about poo and wee quite a lot, which, you know, I think kids are up on that. And also we have a new series coming up, which starts recording on October the 16th. We've got some great guests coming up, including October the 16th, Ellie Taylor. October the, whatever it'll be, 23rd is Armando Iannucci. November the 20th, I think, is Richard Osman. And there's lots of other very exciting people in the mix. People are a bit slow getting back to me this time, but hopefully we'll nail that down pretty soon. So do book it. Those go to lesssquaretheatre.com and you can find my page and book tickets to that. It'd be lovely to see you if you want to come along. Anyway, let's sit back and enjoy Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who is willing to talk about the tactics of Monopoly for a lot longer than most other people would think was reasonable. It's Richard Herring! Hello! Hello, London! It's good to be back. Soon I won't be living in London. That's terrifying, isn't it? Feels like a week ago I was saying that, but it can't have been. It's lovely to be here at the Leicester Square Theatre. This is Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. But I was talking to some of the crazy crocos recently, who you may remember in the 1990s were the figures given away in Kinder Eggs. They were very popular. And though none of them can actually literally speak,
I did feel that they would call it Rehearsed to Pay Figures. They're very cool. It's all cracking on, getting very close to the imminent death of being old. How old are you, sir? 45. I thought you were over 50. I thought you'd be able to give me some advice about. I can give you some advice about. But you know, he looks so young. How old are you? 51. How did you cope with turning 50? The big 50, as I no one calls it. You contented yourself at home with your 25-year-old wife. So is that your advice to me to do the same? I'm very happy to give it a crack if you don't mind. No? Okay. She has standards. Yeah, maybe. She's not here tonight, so that would imply she does have standards. Good. How old are you, sir? 44. So kind of some kind of middle-aged man, but younger. The kind of guys who are watching me on Fist of Fun and looked up to me as a sort of god. And then have grown up with me still. Well, that's nice to know. Are you looking forward to turning 50? It's 6 years away, but it goes fast. You can't wait. You're going to have to wait 6 years, but it's going to be very quick, don't worry. So we're going to crack straight on with this week's guest. It's a very... last week we had someone called Brian who doesn't drink alcohol, and in a way this week we've got the same, though you might not realise that. He's probably best known as the milkman from Filthy Rich and Catflap. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Arthur Smith! Ladies and gentlemen, here he is! Arthur Smith. Love to see you. Welcome. Pull up a chair, pull up a microphone. How are you?
I'm extremely handsome.
You are.
I don't know why everyone's laughed.
You've still got it, Arthur, you've still got it. So, do you remember being on Filthy Rich and Catflap?
I do dimly, yes.
Yeah.
I was the milkman, and I got killed, didn't
did you?
I?
Oh.
I think someone smashed a Rick Mayall or someone smashed a glass over my head.
Bloody hell.
And I died.
Bloody hell.
It was good. I got to keep one of the bottles, you know, that you can smash people over the head with.
Yeah.
Which aren't real glass. Yeah. They're not dangerous. And I did a joke with a friend. I was in one car, he was in the car behind. We pretended to have an argument, and I smashed it over his head. And was arrested.
Immediately. Now, I'm about to turn 50, and in 2 days' time. And you were at my 30th birthday drum party. Do you remember this?
Of course I don't.
No, you came to... I lived in Balham at the time, and you gate-crashed my 30th birthday party.
Oh, yeah, I used to love gate-crashing parties.
It's much
better than if you're invited.
It was in Goblins, where we both drank occasionally.
Oh, yeah. Where they used to play Monopoly.
They did, and Scrabble. They used to play a lot of Scrabble down. We'll get on to that later. If things are going badly, we'll have an half an hour conversation about that. You wrote me a poem for my 30th birthday as a gift.
Shall I tell you how it went? Blimey, right.
It wasn't a very long poem, but this is how it went. I've still got it up on my notice board at home, so I could check this. Rage and balloon, sage and buffoon.
Yeah, well.
It's all right, isn't it?
As my mother would say, well, I've tried my best.
it rhymes twice.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was sort of, there was not
what
much rage.
Again? Rage.
Rage and balloon, that's the party. Sage and buffoon. I think you're implying that I'm an angry and happy man who's stupid and clever.
Well, wise, sages.
Wise, yeah.
Yeah. You know, the French for midwife is sage-femme.
I did not know that. We were talking about... You can speak French. You were the first person to do a stand-up gig in French, I understand.
Yeah, long before Eddie, may I say. Eddie Izzard. And in fact, I did support Eddie doing a French gig a couple of summers ago. Yeah. Yeah, I did a 10-minute stand-up routine in Paris in about 1992 or something.
Right.
And it was an interesting experience to do. I mean, I was thinking when you see comedians who are, who come over here, Henning, Venn, and, various people for whom English is not their first language.
Yeah.
That's pretty tough doing stand-up in it.
Yeah. Well, because I think for you especially, stand-up's so much about language and words, and all your writing is very intricate, I think, and that you're much more of a word than a physical comedian, I think it's fair to say. Though
Although, sometimes I use a small number of words.
You do.
Here's a fact. Did you know one out of three Americans weighs as much as the other two? You know, I do a gag as well.
It is. But I've, you know, I can't speak any languages well enough to do gigs, but when I've gone
Your English is not bad.
It's okay. But when I go to, sometimes you go to foreign countries and do a gig in English to the locals, and then you realise how much you're...
Where have you played abroad?
I've played places like Serbia, I've done Belgium.
How did you go down in Serbia?
Not very well, because I realised it was the first time I'd done a gig abroad, and I'd just started coming back to stand-up anyway. And you just realise how much is the vernacular and the idiom you're using, and that people need to understand.
And also the order of words that you use. Some, you know, one way it's funny and another way or less the same, but it isn't somehow.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But yeah, it's hats off to anyone who can do, as you say, the foreign people coming over here and making a living in their second language and managing
to... I remember introducing the first ever Swedish comedian at the Comedy Store. And... he got one small laugh when he said, "Hello, I'm a comedian from Sweden." and that was it.
So I like to show off that this year is my 30th anniversary of my first Edinburgh, but then this year is also your 40th anniversary of your first Edinburgh.
Yes.
So you've won that competition.
Yes.
Are you going to make it, and you're going up to the Fringe this year?
Yeah, I am. I'm doing the last sort of version, a slightly reworked version of my Arthur Smith Sings Leonard Cohen show, which does sound like the grimmest evening of entertainment imaginable. But I can promise you it's rather good, which is partly Leonard Cohen's songs. There's quite a lot of, you know, reflection on humour and enthusiasm and dementia and diminishment and darkness and death. But it's not all comedy. You know, I do sing a few Leonard Cohen songs because I think he should have won the Nobel Prize probably rather than Bob Dylan in a way. Who agrees? Yeah, I mean, he's a proper poet, Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
And I love poetry. And it's funny, I think poetry kind of can fit in with stand-up a bit, I've discovered. You know, sometimes if I'm doing like a long set, I'll just do a couple of poems, which aren't meant to be funny necessarily, or I've got some funny ones too, and people kind of enjoy them, I've discovered.
Yeah, good. Yeah. You got one up your sleeve?
If you like. All right, this is a poem of optimism by a woman who, she's a bit sick of it by now, so she doesn't like her name said, but this is a poem called Sometimes. Sometimes things don't go after all from bad to worse. Some years muscatel faces down frost, green thrives to crops don't fail. Sometimes a man aims high and all goes well. A people will sometimes step back from war, elect an honest man, decide they care enough they cannot leave some stranger poor. Some men become what they were born for. Sometimes our best efforts do not go amiss. Sometimes we do as we meant to. The sun will sometimes melt a field of sorrow that seemed hard frozen. May it happen for you.
Hey. Sage and buffoon. It's all sage and buffoon tonight.
Well, I'll do another one at the end.
Okay, that's nice.
I'll do a bit of Shakespeare too, if you like.
Okay.
I've done it. I did a version of Hamlet myself.
You did. I featured a little bit in that one.
That's right. You did. That's right. Yes. Perhaps you'd like to explain to the audience how it was that you featured
this. I was dating an actress called Sally Phillips shortly before that. You did that to Hamlet, who co-starred as Ophelia in Hamlet. But then we broke up with each other shortly before that Hamlet, and therefore I became the...
Yeah, because I had said to Sally, she was being my Ophelia. I said, well, look, just come on and shout and be completely bonkers about whatever's pissing you off at the moment. Which, as it turned out, was having been dumped by Richard. Or as he was known in the thing, I at least got them to change the name to Dick Kipper.
And no one saw through that.
I felt a bit guilty about that because I mean, it wasn't, you know, I had to, you know, that's what she wanted to do. And,
to be honest, I loved it. I didn't love so much that I became the centre of that particular thing, but the show was really lovely, and I'm such a big fan of yours that I've sort of felt this weird honour about being included in your show, even though it was, I think in the end she sort of came round to maybe understanding that
there was some small degree of redemption.
There was a little bit. To be honest, it was worse in real life than it was watching the fictional version of it. But
come on, tell us about some of your other old girlfriends, Richard.
There are.
I know one or two myself.
There are a couple. But you've done. Well, you've been a feature of my Edinburgh's all the way through, really. And I remember the first time I went up in 1987. I saw you do a show. I think with. I guess a bit conflated in my mind, but I saw some stand-up shows, but I think there was one where you were doing a triple night with maybe Arnold Brown and maybe Jerry Sadovitz or maybe Norman Lovett. It was one of those triple bill.
It was late night at the Gilded Balloon.
It was indeed. And so we were sort of blown away by this because we were doing kind of university review at the time. We thought this is incredible what people are doing here in Edinburgh. And but then I remember later on seeing you propped up at a bar on your own and looking quite miserable, and I said to my friend, oh God, is, you know, this is what I want to do, is that what's going to happen to me?
It was
exactly what happened.
Well, I don't know, sometimes, like, you know, just because you're on your own, it doesn't mean you're miserable necessarily. No, I probably will say, I don't know, but you know, I find it a kind of pleasure. I remember doing a gig where I had no reason to stick around at the end, you know, and I got a round of applause. And I just walked straight out the back, and I could still hear the applause fading as I began my walk alone along the river.
Yeah.
And, you know, the contrast between standing in the middle and waving at everyone and being Mr., you know, a bit, and that, and then just strolling along by yourself, I find stimulating.
I think it is, once you get used to it. And I guess, from my point of view as a new, and not even a comedian at that stage, someone who wanted an aspirant comedian, I think you imagine, oh, it will all be like, you'll come off stage and you'll be surrounded by people and garlanded and being witty. And, of course, in reality, you sort of want to be.
Yeah.
You want to leave it behind and you want to sit
down. Yeah, and then there's those long open mic nights where there's just three people in the audience and one of them's dead. Hundreds of them. I mean, there's so many comedians now, aren't there?
There are. Well, it's insane compared. Even when I started, which, you know, 87, but in the early 90s, there might have been maybe 30 comedians up in the Fringe doing
shows.
Yeah,
well, yeah.
And when you started, there must have been, like, four or five
three
shows.
Three of us, yeah.
And so
right.
Now it's like 1,000, I think maybe 1,000 comedians are up there, aren't they? Is that, am I overestimating that? But it's something
know.
Like that.
And how? And for every one of those, there's probably, you know, 50 who are doing the open mic circuit.
Yeah, yeah. So
how many people here are doing the open mic circuit?
No,
they're all off at the gigs.
They're all working hard pre-Edinburgh. But also, there was an Edinburgh show where, and I can't remember the name of this Edinburgh show, but it completely, out of many of your shows that I've seen, it blew me away the most. It was the one did in the Botanical Garden.
Oh, yeah, yeah, was, yeah. That was fun. That was an outdoor show.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I used to do them. I think they do them a bit more now, but no one really did them then.
No.
And I. Yeah, and it was in the Inverleith putting green, and I had, like, various people stationed on the way round, someone standing in a pond, and then you can do shows, gags on a huge scale or something like that. So I had Andy Smart about 200 yards away from this woman. They ran at each other, you know, and so it was a huge scale.
Yeah.
I did another one a few years later where I ended it at the foot of Salisbury Crags, you know, which is just by Arthur's Seat, and I had six ballet dancers set way up on the sort of on the top, and, you know, cued by text. And I mean, the scale of the gag, I was really proud of it.
Well, that's what I remember. If I remember, I'd gone. It was right at the end of the Fringe. It was just, I mean, it was what the Fringe should be about, because it was a one-off show, that Botanical Gardens almost.
Yeah, I think I did two or something.
But it's like, so you'd worked throughout the Fringe with all the actors, I presume, and you'd kind of worked out what you were going to do.
Yeah.
And I'd gone in very. I'd had some. Some love affair had gone badly again.
And which one was this then, Richard?
this was another actress. When I stopped dating actresses, things improved quite a lot.
Have you ever snogged a woman who won an Oscar?
No, I don't think I have, no. I'm presuming you have, Arthur. If only I could think of an actress from a long time ago that had won an Oscar, that would be...
Gina Lollobrigida. Yeah.
But I went in quite depressed, and I came out like a late... You know, I just felt so happy. It was such
oh,
a...
Oh, well, I'll take that. That's one of the pleasures of the job, isn't it?
Is, yeah.
You can enliven, you know, and stimulate a group of people and make them make that funny noise, which is laughter.
and feeling. I mean, I think you're really someone who does Edinburgh properly and always has. You do. You're taking chances. You did an art exhibitions one year, and you've done.
Yeah, and I had my exhibition of socks last year.
That's right.
Yeah, no, I'm big on socks. Yeah. And I had all sorts of old socks that I'd had made, obviously, really. I had, you know, Alexander's sock that he wore as he entered the gates of Constantinople. And a pair of prince's socks are only that big, you know. And it was quite fun, the sock exhibition. Well, I had this idea, and a couple years before, yeah, I did this Archer Art thing, because I noticed about the art world is very serious. You never hear laughter in an art gallery, do you?
No.
And I felt you should. Yeah. You know, comedy doesn't make something lack any artistic proclivity, so fuck it. So yeah. I did a funny art exhibition, yeah. Which cost me a fortune.
But you've also used to do like proper, you've done several proper plays and very successful plays up there.
I've done
the Bed Show and the Evening with Gary Lineker.
I've never done a dance show though.
No, well, there's still time.
Perhaps you and I should do one.
I think Tony Law and Phil Nichol are doing some kind of physical dance show. Thing.
Excellent. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It looks very exciting from the poster.
Good. I like the way, you know, people experiment with the form. Yeah. I mean, there's like wrestling matches now, aren't there? I suppose wrestling always has been funny in a way. It's like pantomime, isn't it? Yeah. With the sort of baddies and the...
Yeah, that was a sharp thing for them to realise. And you were offered the Lifetime Perrier Award in about 2005, which you turned down.
Yeah. it wasn't any money attached to it. So I did accept it a couple of years later I got $3,000 as okay. well. Fuck that. My principles aren't that much. But I fucking hate award ceremonies.
Yeah.
They're boring.
It's sort of weird for Edinburgh as well, isn't it? Because it's, you know, again, the more stuff there is there, the more ridiculous it becomes. Because how do you, and even if you were to compare all your shows, if we said, what's the best Arthur Smith show, you'd have your personal opinion. But it's how do you compare some socks to some people up in the mountain doing ballet, you know, which is the best of those two?
If you were offered an OBE, would you accept it, Richard?
I don't think I would. I've got friends who have done so.
It's really? Hard to know.
Well, Armando Iannucci.
Oh, that's right. Didn't he? I was slightly surprised by that.
Yeah. I was having a discussion with someone on Twitter about this, and they were saying that he now had no right to say anything about the royal family because he'd accepted an OBE from them, which I think is... I understand it, but I also think you don't lose the right to free speech because you've made a decision. A lot of people say it's for their parents.
Well, funny enough, I happen to know... the person who's the chair of the Honours Committee.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, no, really. And he tells me that what he does is, like, say with Andy Murray, because he won one, didn't he?
Yeah.
He initially turned it down, but what he does, he rings up, he rang up Andy Murray's mother and his wife.
Yeah.
And then Andy Murray rang back and said, all right, I'll accept it. That's the way to do it.
It's a difficult one because you are sort of, there is a history to it, and it's still got the British Empire at the end of it, and it sort of does seem to say, I'm accepting that I'm a part of this. But you can also see it as I'm proud of the country I'm from, and I'm proud to have an honour. I
mean, and would you accept it then?
I don't think I would, but I've done this very lightly, I'd be offered one either, so it's easy for me
well,
to
also,
say.
Well, also, I mean, certainly when I started out in comedy, it was sort of. Part of the thing was to be anti-royal, in a way, was to be Republican. But I notice Republicanism, it hardly exists anymore, does it?
Yeah, it's true. It's not in the same way. But
who's a Republican here? See, no one. But I mean, I remember on days like, when Prince Charles got married, I went to France for the day just to fucking escape it all.
It turned out well for him, though, didn't it? It was a happy...
Do you think...
That wasn't as bad as Sally Phillips, let's face it.
Did you go out with Lady Di as well?
Well, you know what? I once managed to flirt with Lady Diana I went to Wimbledon with Sally Phillips when I was going out with Sally Phillips. Her dad was a tennis player.
And you dropped off.
and I was looking... We were sitting quite near the Royal Box... or to give her official title, the Princess of Wales. That joke went down a lot better before she died, I have to say. And and she was sort of about 20 feet away from me, and I was sort of looking over her, and then she sort of sensed that someone was looking at her, which she must be all the time.
And you were taken security.
She turned around and looked right at me, and I just sort of didn't know what to do, so I pulled a stupid face. And
then
she
see the face you pulled.
I went... something along those lines. And she laughed. She laughed and kind of gave me that very flirtatious look. And then everyone else around me sort
so
of...
So you could have shagged.
I think if I hadn't been with my girlfriend at the time and if I'd known what was to come in the future, I'd have just been off. I think it would have been a bad place.
I'd like to point out, I once turned down Edwina Curry. I clear the front pages.
Well, I've got a question about that in my emergency questions about who's the most right-wing person you found sexually attractive, but you didn't. She found you attractive and you didn't want
to. There was a bit of a knock on the door.
Was there?
Yeah, but we were doing some gig together and she was the keynote speaker, whatever the fuck that means.
Right.
And I was the comedian and she came on and did her keynote speech, which no one really listened to. And anyway, but then we were in the same hotel because it was in Dublin or Aberdeen or something anyway, and then there was a knock on the door. Arthur, hello. Do you want to come into my room for a cup of tea?
Mm.
Well, I don't know. Maybe she just wanted a cup of
Good
tea.
Been.
But I had a thing. I vowed when Thatcher got in that I was never going to have sex with a Conservative voter.
Right.
And my resolve was tested only once, to my knowledge. And I'm pleased to say I went home and pleasured myself in a socialist way.
Although, you know, a lot of people say fuck the Tories, don't they? So it would have been...
Arthur Scargill told me once.
Yeah, I thought you were
going to... I'll just stop there, shall I? That Thatcher had shagged... a member of parliament, one Tory and one Labour.
Right.
I mean, as to whether this is true or not, I could never know. But.
Right. It's interesting. I was on a reality thing, TV show thing with Jonathan Aitken, who I actually got...
Oh, God, you poor bastard.
We kind of got on quite well by ignoring our massive differences in anything political.
What was this reality show?
It was that we did a rowing thing, and it was kind of a crazy thing, because they really wanted... There's no one famous they could get on. It was like Oxford versus Cambridge rowing
race. See, yeah.
And they couldn't find anyone good, and Jonathan Aitken was the only famous person they got, but he was gigantic, but too old to row.
And so
he
was skin.
And I was tired. I was skin. I need the money. But he was the cox of our thing, even though he was 6 foot tall and the rest of us were 5 foot tall. But he liked drinking, but then, you know, his daughters were at school with Khashoggi's daughter, weren't they? And then they went, we look very similar, don't we? We look very the same. And then they discovered through that Aitken had been fucking the oil baron Khashoggi's
wife. And it was his daughter.
So it was his daughter. So they just were all...
Oh, dear. Must be a desperately sad, odd thing to discover
that
your father's not the person you felt it was.
Yeah, well, but I think that's what... They had all this, you know, pretension of being, you know, moral and whatever. And I think they're living this kind of... this lifestyle of debauchery. I sort of quite liked him, but I never... We don't stay in touch. We enjoyed... Is he here? Are you in, Jonathan?
How long did he... did time inside, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. This was after he'd been in prison.
Have you ever been in prison?
No, I don't think I've even...
Have you ever been arrested?
No.
What a wanker.
I don't think so, no.
You've never been arrested?
What if I won? What I did? What?
You went to Wookiee Hall Plain to watch a bit of porn.
I went to Wookiee Hall Plain. I went to Wells. I went to Wells Cinema. It's very different to watch an 18 film when I was 14. I don't think they arrest you for that. I think they throw you out of the cinema if they find you. I've done very little of any work.
I'll give you
Have
a
you been
bit
arrested?
Of, I'll give you a little one little bit of advice I've learned in life. About the only thing I've ever learned: never smoke a joint outside Bishopsgate Police Station. But I've been arrested twice. Well, three times really, but only really twice. But I was arrested at the end of my Edinburgh tour.
Yes.
For breach of the peace and possession of a megaphone. That's what they say.
This is your 2 o'clock in the morning, you go on a tour of Edinburgh. And
yeah, it's a late night. And Simon Munnery was arrested as well. And I must admit, I'm rather proud to have been arrested at the end of a gig. I mean, there's me, Lenny Bruce. I mean, who else has been arrested at the end of a gig?
It's true.
There must be some. Does anyone know? There must be a comedy nerd out there.
I think you hear stories occasionally. I've had instances where people in the audience have been arrested. When we were in Montreal, there was a guy who had a gun.
That's a big heckle.
And then he took it out outside of the gig, but I was taking the piss out of him in the gig, not knowing he had a gun.
Bloody hell. Well, I was comparing once at Jonglers in the 80s, I think this was, and there was an act on, and his name was in the listings, and although he was only really doing a tryout, he was doing 10 minutes or something. And when he came off stage, he'd done all right. He was arrested, and it turned out he was a wanted man, and the police had seen his name in the listings. You thought, that's bad luck, isn't it? I mean, there's going down badly and then getting arrested at the end of it, you know.
But your worst heckle, you had something poured over you that was probably your worst heckle.
Someone poured a pint of urine over me while in my new suit. In fact, I think Tara, who's here, was there on that occasion, or at least it was the suit you gave me anyway. Yes, I got covered in piss. But he was enjoying my set. I mean, God knows what he'd have done if he'd hated it. But I remember doing a gig once where the heckle was... it wasn't to me, it was a bloke who was on before, but he was quite old, he wasn't doing very well, and suddenly a woman's voice rang out, "Excuse me, I think you really need to think about the way your life is going." You know, not just your act is shit, so it's the whole point of your existence. Well, what's the worst heckle you've ever had?
Oh, well, they're never very good, are they? When we did Lee and Herring, I used to pick on someone who looked like the youngest boy in the front row. So I was a 13-year-old, and I'd kind of go at them saying, "Yeah, I earn my money and you get it from your mum." And then we'd say, "Heckle me back, heckle me back." And one kid said, "The sleeves of your jacket are slightly frayed."
And they were.
So, A, that very perceptive sight of a 13-year-old, but also that's kind of amazing. And I hadn't realised I looked, and it was an amazing takedown, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sort of says more than that, because it's like, yeah, you know, whatever you think.
I remember nearly right at the beginning of my career, I was remembering this with Paul Merton just 2 days ago, because he was 60 2 days ago. Anyway. And when we were sharing a bill in Swansea, and a woman shouted out, "Why don't you go back to London and leave us all alone?" And she really meant it, you know.
Calm down.
She was Welsh, all right?
Calm down.
Yes, my accent, I'm not very good at accents, and I can do Dylan
do
Thomas.
"Why don't you go back to London and leave us all alone?"
Can you do any impressions, Richard?
Can I do impressions? I'm not very versatile.
There must be one you could do.
I could do Charlie Borman.
I can do Dylan Thomas segueing into Frankie Howard.
Okay.
"Do not go gentle into that good night." "No, Mrs. Don't." God, I've done that joke for 25 years.
Well, let's talk about the... I love talking about the early days of stand-up, which you obviously were right there as alternative comedy began. I mean, you sort of were there when it started. You almost started it.
I wasn't at that first night at the Comedy Store. I had applied to be.
They
had a thing in Time Out saying, looking for new young comedians for a new club. And I wrote back saying, yeah, count me in. But I never got a reply on it, so I never did it. But I did go there about a year later. It was an exciting time.
It was, yeah. And what was the craziest act around that time?
Blimey. I remember an act called... who are those terrible... a drag act who came on as Myra Hindley and read out Little Red Riding Hood, which, if you recall, involves... Anyway. And I remember a tap dancer, but he was let down by the fact there was a carpet on the stage... There was... Sylvie Bottle Knocker, who used to be able to open a bottle of beer with her tits. I can't remember. Sorry to have placed that image in your mind.
Just trying to work out how.
I can't really remember quite how it worked. It was some dodgy night club in Islington, I remember.
There was, I mean, even because I was
came to it in the late 80s and early 90s, and there were still a few vestiges of those sort of things going on, but not as many.
Yeah,
as
well, there's still some wacky acts out there. There's no doubt, because there's so many of them. You know, there's all sorts of ridiculous ones, you see.
I think it's come back round. There are clubs where you can go and do those real avant-garde stuff. I think there was a time in the 90s when it became very male stand-up.
Yeah, just blokes with their hands in their pockets talking about wanking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of us have kept that going for a long time.
Have you actually done a whole show about wanking?
Not just about wanking, but it always features. There's always some in there somewhere. But okay, I'll ask you an emergency question. I'll ask you this one. I think you might have an answer to this. This is a new one.
I'm quite good on capitals.
Okay. Have you ever fallen downstairs?
Yes, of course I have. What do you think I am? A fucking sober rep. Yes, I have.
The most memorable falling downstairs incident.
When I was 6 years old, and I fell down the stairs, and I can feel it to this moment, my nose hit the corner of the thing, and I broke my nose, I think, although I was never, because I was being babysit by my granny. And in fact, because of that, I've got a fucking dodgy, ugly nose ever since. I'd say, can you see a bit of a break in it?
Yes.
And that was, it's not a very amusing anecdote.
No, it doesn't have to be. We're just trying to change
Have you fallen downstairs?
I fell downstairs about...
It's a classic way for comedians to die, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
That and setting fire to the front room when they go to bed and leave a fag going.
That's a good way to go. I fell downstairs taking a breakfast up to my wife in bed, which that's why you must never do that. And I was a bit tired. I had a whole tray of breakfast, and then so I slipped. And then I was more concerned with the breakfast that I'd created. And so then I literally fell down about 8 or 9 steps, and with
still
coffee
holding
and a
the
tray
breakfast.
And porridge and everything all over me.
And did your wife enjoy that breakfast in bed?
She didn't get any breakfast. I probably then went and made her another breakfast. That's how good a husband I am.
What's the closest you've come to dying?
I'm not very close. I know that you have.
Oh, that's disappointing. But it must be like where you were nearly run over or you've...
When I was on my year off, I went to Camp America, and on the last day of Camp America, luckily when all the kids have gone, we're in the middle of a redwood forest, and we had a party, and then someone left a cigarette somewhere, and this whole... the cabin went up in flames, and then the whole forest started going up in flames. And we were woken up 3 o'clock in the morning very drunk by this fire alarm and had to put out this fire ourselves.
Quite exciting.
Yeah. So we could have. It just rained a little bit the night before, and for the first time the whole summer, and there was no wind. But there was 100 miles to the nearest fire station, so we just had to ferry big things of water up the hill. But I was fine. I survived. Here I am.
Well, obviously, yeah.
But you became very close to dying.
That for a couple of times. But, yeah, principally when I was ill, it's because I'd been drinking too much. I was taken to hospital and with a awful pain in my stomach, and I had acute necrotizing pancreatitis, which meant that my pancreas was essentially sort of eating itself. I was in intensive care, and I was more likely to die than live at one point. But which actually, if you know, that which does not kill you makes you stronger. It was rather an extraordinary experience, obviously. You know, when I came out, I felt, well, one thing I'd learned is that I really like morphine. By the way. But, I came out and I felt a sort of lightness and an ability to cherish the world that just because it wasn't gone, as I feared.
And how old were you then? You were still quite...
I was in my late 40s.
Yeah. So, thank goodness you survived that, but I remember it being a...
Well, yeah, it was a time, it was just around the same time Malcolm Hardy died and Linda Smith as well.
Yeah.
Who remembers Linda? Yeah. I still occasionally nick... Let's have a round of applause for Linda Smith. I still think Linda had the best analysis of our problems with the Middle East. She said the trouble with the Middle East is that somehow our oil has ended up under their sand. Yeah, here's another one of Linda's. She said, if God had wanted us to believe in him, he would have existed.
Yeah. It's all right to nick jokes when someone's dead, right? That's
well,
okay.
That's what I thought.
Linda, I think
you
keep them alive. Yeah. Appropriate, of course.
And I've referenced it.
You certainly have. You were in that Red Dwarf episode that my fans will want to hear about.
Yes. So, have you got a few dwarfies in tonight?
Yeah, I thought they might be interested.
Yeah. Well, I auditioned for the part that Robert Llewellyn played.
I did the role, Crichton.
Yeah, Crichton, that's right. Yeah, God, I'm glad I didn't get the part. Poor bastard, old Robert had to spend 2 hours in makeup before everyone else got there.
Although no one recognises him, I kind of think that's... You know, probably a blessing, isn't it? You do in something very successful,
yeah,
and then
probably.
You can still walk down the street. And
yeah. I mean, Craig went a bit mad, didn't he, for a while?
And it was the backwards episode. It was a very good episode of Red Dwarf.
Oh, it was
brilliant.
I mean, it was a wonderful original concept.
Yeah.
And I landed in a planet where everything went backwards, so my scene was going to be run backwards. So I said to Robert Duck, well, it doesn't matter what the fuck I say, does it? So I kind of went on and swore when it went out, it was like that. But of course, people have run it back since and caught me saying, what a load of bollocks. And I remember being in the studio audience, looked rather shocked after I'd done that. Yeah. I'm glad I did, though.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting to talk about that, the fame thing, because I think you sort of, I've seen you quoted saying the best kind of fame is sort of mild fame, the kind of fame that you...
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine what it must be like, you know, being, you know, Meryl Streep or something, because wherever you go, people are going to be kind of looking at you and coming up, and whereas, you know, I'm recognised a little bit, and mostly it's... fairly pleasant, and occasionally you can get a favour out of it, you know.
Yeah.
Provided you don't take it too seriously as well, you can bring sort of pleasure to people, because, you know, there are people in my family or, you know, and they get pleasure if I send a card or turn up at some event and play Mr. Showbiz a bit. I mean, I know it's all bullshit, but people like it, so, you know, I'll play along with it to give them some pleasure.
Well, you seem to have a nice life, I think, for looking from the outside.
Of course, despair and disillusion are essential moments in the progress of the intellectual soul.
Yeah.
And I still think, sort of, you know, man is a fallen god who remembers heaven, as Anthea Turner remarked. You know, it's not to say I don't suffer some angoisse, as any right-thinking person does. I mean, what a bizarre thing to be a human being.
It is weird.
I was like that moment, there's that kind of nanosecond when you wake up in the morning and you don't really know what the fuck you are. You know, and then you're like, oh, yeah, I'm a human. Oh, yeah, I'm that bloke. Oh, yeah, and I've got to go and fucking do Richard's show. You sort of like download. But there is a moment when you're just a kind of living thing with no knowledge of yourself, which is essentially what we are.
Yeah, it is. If you think about it too much, it's a very strange thing that we have. It doesn't feel like it's possible. The world and the human race out of everything that's...
Maybe it isn't. Maybe we're all part of your dream.
I hope so. It's good. It's been a good dream. If it's, I hope we don't wake up too soon. And you're self-styled Mayor of Balham.
Oh, yes, I am the Mayor of Balham, self-proclaimed. Nightmare, I don't do days. I have lived in Balham for a long time, and I well remember the occasion when I proclaimed myself Mayor at my grand ceremony in Sainsbury's car park. And I sang the song that I wrote especially for the occasion, which went, I am the Mayor of Balham. Oh, yes, I fucking am. I am the Mayor of Balham. I fucking am. Everybody? I am the Mayor of Balham. Oh, yes, I fucking am. I am the Mayor of Balham. I fucking am. That's all we got time for on Start the Week. Yeah, no, and I rather enjoy. I realise it's a game that Londoners play and have done, you know, for 200 years or something, the North v South London thing. You know, like, who here's from South London? Yeah. Who's from North London? Scum. Because occasionally I have foreigners, and, you know, you play the game of they're all fucking arseholes in North London, posh bastards, you know. In North London, they've got little blue plaques commemorating famous people. In South London, we have big yellow signs saying, did you see this murder? And, you know, London's, you know, you say you're moving to the country.
I'm moving to the countryside on Friday, although not, I'm moving in
and
my in-laws.
Back again on Sunday?
Yeah, maybe. Well, we'll see. We'll see how we do.
Where are you going?
It's just out into Hertfordshire, middle of Hertfordshire, near Hitchin.
Why are you doing this?
Well, you know, it's a good question. It'll be nice to, you know, be out in the countryside, wouldn't it, and have some fresh air. I've got a child and a child on the way.
Yeah, but what are you going to do in the evenings? As I believe Woody Allen said. Yeah, no, I mean, I think everyone has a sort of, you know, Londoner has a sort of vague fantasy of buying a big jumper and going to live in Cornwall or something.
Yeah.
But I think... See? Yeah, I mean, we all have that little fantasy, but I think most Londoners will be bored shitless after 2 days.
Well, we'll see. I think it's near enough to London that I can come into London quite a lot, but we'll see if that happens.
Yeah.
And we'll see if we, you know... We
maybe you'll get right into the local thing, join the local village panto.
Yeah, I might do.
Yeah, to get enter your roses into the flower competition.
I might do.
Yeah.
Get into wife swapping and getting drunk in the... You know,
that's right. Don't you have to plant that special plant outside your house
for
that?
Is that what you do for that?
Well, yeah, pampasgrass. Supposedly, any house with pampasgrass
right.
inside their swingers.
Okay, I'll look out for those.
It certainly wasn't true when I knocked on that door. I know, the mysterious life of the village. Also, you see, if you live in something like that, everyone gets to know you.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't want to be known by everyone. Would you? You know, like...
London's the opposite, isn't it? And so I've lived in this house I live in at the moment for 14 years, and it took me about 8 years before I even really spoke to anyone in the street.
Yeah. Well,
and I'm not really friends with anyone in the street. So yeah. It's kind of the opposite of that, isn't it? So you will get to have to talk to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most shocking things you ever see if someone starts talking to you on the tube. For fuck's sake, what's going on here? That's how... Ray, what do you think I am, fucking Italian?
Well, when I lived in Ballon, we would occasionally meet on the tube, because obviously we were going in, and you'd go, we don't have to talk to each other, do we? No, it's fine.
I'm a grouchy fan.
But I also feel like that occasionally you really meet someone on the...
Yeah, especially like you have to have really the conversation in public. Well, the worst thing is, if you know, you get on a train in Edinburgh, go into London, and just see the most boring man you've ever met... getting on the train next to you, yeah. And then he comes and sit next to you. Oh, no. That was you, wasn't it?
It was
Richard?
Me. And now you've come and subjected yourself to an hour with me. I had a great documentary with you. I mean, you've done so many things on the radio and TV, but I'm sort of fascinated by Colditz and prisoners of war. And your dad was in Colditz.
My father's war... He was called up and he was captured at El Alamein in 1942, and then he was transported to Italy, and he was paraded through the streets of Palermo. Then he was down a copper mine, like slave labour in Saxony, and then he ended the war, though, in Colditz Castle.
Right.
I do a bit of a joke, because I did take him back there when he was 70, and at this point, it had turned half of it into a hotel, and we booked in, and he rang down to room service and asked for a shovel. Which he did, really, obviously. But he did once. We were having a conversation about it, and he's, you know, they were starving, especially when he was in Italy. He was absolutely starving, and he said, we used to eat anything. We'd eat a dead dog. And I said, oh, well, you know, what does dog taste like? And he genuinely said, you know, it's a bit like rat. But, yeah, he was a prisoner of war for 3 years and was finally liberated from Colditz in 1945. I took him back there, and I've been back there once since. It's this rather extraordinary medieval castle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, he was telling me about the day that they were liberated, and you know, the Americans were coming in, and but they weren't sure what this, if this castle was, you know. But anyway, they managed to get a flag up, and this exhausted American GI gets the gates of the castle. The German, you know, puts his thing down, surrenders. He opens the door, and then there's 1,000 shouting men come at him, and he fucking hell. And then only then does he realise this is that, you know, these guys have all just become free.
Yeah.
And my dad, who was, Jesus, he was quite a, he could pull the ladies, my dad. Because on that day, so he's free to, you know, while they're waiting for, you know, in a few days' time, a thing would come and take them back. But he went out into town where he managed to cop off with a Polish waitress just, you know, 2 hours after he was released. When you've got to think, there was quite a lot of competition for a Polish waitress. But because I got him to write his memoir before he died, and there's some amazing stories those guys lived through. He's got one where after the war he signed up again because he had no work, and was sent to Yugoslavia. Anyway, he got a week's holiday in Venice, you know, and he'd never stayed in a hotel, or, you know, he'd done prisoner of war. So he goes in this hotel, but and he goes out for a swim on the Venice Lido and sees a woman in a bikini, which had just been invented, these, you know, the bikinis, because of the Bikini Atoll nuclear test. Yeah. Anyway, and my dad then said he didn't go back there until he spent a week with this woman. She didn't speak English, he didn't speak Italian, but, you know, I'm guessing there was quite a lot of shagging went on. And she took him to various... And she was an orphan. She'd been orphaned. Her parents had been killed in the bombing of Milan. Anyway, at the end of the week, my dad... It had obviously been a fantastic week. He offered her some money. And she said, oh, you think I'm a prostitute, do you? And got pissed off at him, so it all ended badly. Oh. Went back to Yugoslavia. And then months later, he discovered she had made, which would have been a really perilous journey, the journey to his army camp in Yugoslavia, as it was then, and tried to get in touch to make contact with him, but had been turned away at the, you know, the gates of the army camp, and he never saw her again. But you think, you know, what an extraordinary little romance, and whatever happened to her.
And if she'd got through, you wouldn't be here.
No, or maybe I'd be Italian. Doing my funny Italian. Oh dear, this is embarrassing.
It's from a different time.
The old defence. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la delita via era smarrita.
That's nice.
That's the opening lines of The Inferno by Dante, which I learned to impress an Italian au pair girl.
And did it work?
She shagged my friend. Because I think, looking back on it, it's the most famous bit of literature in Italian. It's a bit like To Be or Not To Be. And I think to her I sounded like, you know, to be or not to be is the question. Whether it's nobler in the mind, you know. Would you like to do a bit of Shakespeare in a funny accent, Richard?
I'll do Macbeth. Is this the dagger I keep before me? It's handled toward my hand.
It's a good game, Shakespeare good. In regional accents.
Yeah.
To be or not to be? That's a question, isn't it?
That's presumably how it was done.
Yeah, it probably did sound like that then.
Did. Well, I saw you look at your watch. We're nearly done.
Good. It's late for me.
It's late. It's late for me. I was up at 3:30 this morning.
Really? How many times have I heard that?
Once backstage, once on here. How about Are You Being Served? Shall we talk about Are You Being Served before we go?
Yeah. I was cast in the remake, as one of you two may have seen it. Of Are You Being Served, which was kind of fun.
Well, you played the Arthur English part.
That's right, the sort of the dodgy bloke in the...
Which is good casting.
We're both called Arthur, and we're comedians. Yeah, I mean, frankly, I'm quite glad it didn't get a series. I don't know if I'd want it to be stuck. You know, I've never really liked the idea of being in some endless...
Yeah.
Program that you always have to, you know, I'd rather do what I want to do myself.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was a slightly weird one. I mean, that was an odd little season that they did of...
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting idea, I thought. I mean, I thought there was one I thought was really good. Was it Porridge or something?
Porridge got picked up for a series, and I thought it was... They're good, those.
I thought it was really good,
Clemens and Lefrenny are very sharp writers, I think, so there's only a couple... Given that there must be... In their 80s, are they? It must be 79, 80. Those
yeah, because I interviewed them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You should get them on.
Yeah, well, I would like to, yeah. I should do. I thought that about the other two, the Steptoe two, but one of them's gone now, isn't he?
Better get one of them.
Get one of them on. then it just said the
same
stuff.
Don't end up, though, being the kiss of death. I just did a radio programme series on, so every time we approach someone to do the thing about them, they died.
Yeah.
So Peter Cook and who else is there? Yeah, it's a shame. I was going to go to Gibraltar with Peter Cook.
That would have been amazing. Stuart Lee, I'm sadly not. But sadly, he wasn't asked to be on that series. So far, nobody's been a guest on this show has died. So that is, and we've been going for 5 years. So that's pretty good.
Until now.
Who's the worst one
you've had?
Who's the worst one, a guest
like the
on
most
this?
Annoying guest or the hardest to interview?
Could be. Sometimes, Stuart Lee was the second time was a little bit difficult. The first time he was good. I had a little misunderstanding with Stephen Merchant.
Excellent. I want to hear about this. What happened then?
Well, just, I think he thought I was trying to get him to stitch up. I was making jokes about what's it like being the one in double act who's the best, but everyone that likes the other one more, kind of jokes. And I think he thought I was just talking. I was making a joke about myself.
Can I do a big flounce off to him?
He can do, yes.
Yeah.
Shall I offend you?
Yeah, go on.
You look a bit like Sid James, I've always thought.
That doesn't offend me at all. If that's what you think an offensive remark is, you can fuck off, Richard Herring. Fuck you.
Oh, no, it's all gone wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, Arthur Smith, if that is his real name. You have been listening to Rich Chang's Let's Go Theatre podcast with me, Rich Chang, and my guest, Arthur Smith. The music's by Pest. The other stuff I have to tell you is thank you to the Let's Go Theatre staff and management. Thank you to everyone at GoFasterStrike.com. Thank you to everyone at the British Comedy Guide and iTunes and all the other platforms which kindly released my podcast for free. The producer is Ben Walker. It's a Fuzz, GoFasterStrike.com and Sky Potato production. Thanks for listening. Head to GoFasterStripe.com. You can find out about stuff that you can buy to help the podcast and to help me stay alive. And also go to RichChang.com/gigs to find out if I'm doing my new show anywhere near you soon. Thanks for listening. Go away. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.